pinnacle, I would like to say that clawing your way to the top is but a myth.
Don't lie, don't cheat, don't be afraid.
Girls for a while.
You hung up on a bitch.
I don't want to talk about it.
The only thing you understand is tougher. Tougher. And you know why? Because you are stupid.
How's it feel to be in jail, buddy?
You're in jail, buddy. You're in jail.
And if you don't care and you win, you lose.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 52 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. I'm David Blakeslee, as always, introducing our next film in the chronological journey that I'm on, going through the films of the Criterion Collection. And here we have it, 1971's Drive, He Said, directed by the one and only Jack Nicholson. But Jack does not appear on camera in this one. He is just telling a story and casting his lot as a director. He did not have a very long directorial career, but he did try his hand at it a couple more times over the years. So this is a film that has generated quite a mixed reaction. It's probably considered one of the lesser titles in the heralded BBS America Lost and Found box set, a beautiful Criterion edition. This is spine number 547. One of those unusual offerings where there's two spines on the one case here. Of course, this is part of a big box set packaged along with A Safe Place, which we will be talking about a few episodes down the road from here. But to analyze this little obscure nugget, I've got a couple of guests, including one I've never had on the show before. So I'll introduce him in a moment. But first of all, let's welcome back Derek J. Power. Hello, Derek.
Hey, I'm glad to be back.
Very good. It's nice to have you. We were on just a couple episodes ago, it seems, talking about Jacques Tati's Traffic. I think we had a really fine conversation here about one of the venerable old masters of French comedy and pantomime and art house cinema in general. Here we're taking a look at something a little bit different from all that. But
yep, we returned stateside.
we're back in the States, and we're looking at a very contemporary slice of life. A little chunk out of the zeitgeist here. A college sports film set in the turbulent year of 1971. So we'll get into all of that in a minute, but let's introduce our other guest. This is Richard Doyle coming at us from Winnipeg, Manitoba. Richard, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Well, it's really nice to have you on. I have had the pleasure of following you on Facebook. I think you initiated a little friend request a while back. I assume that's from listening to the podcast. And I really enjoy your feed. You know, I mean, there's a lot of folks who do interesting stuff on Facebook, but you really have quite a barbed sense of humor. Very, very ironic. I don't know where you find those old 1950s recipe ads, among other things. But tell us a little bit about yourself, Richard. This is our first conversation, actually, so I'm looking forward to getting to know you.
Yeah, I generally work in the tech industry. I work for a finance company. I'm what you call a film enthusiast. Pretty enthusiastic. Watch maybe 2 films a day on average. My background is in philosophy. I was working on a PhD, and I withdrew from philosophy because I didn't want to write and I didn't want to teach, and that was pretty much your options.
Okay. But you like to think, obviously, right?
Yes, I like to think, and I like to talk. I didn't much fun, but I realized I can't really do that for a living. So I came back to Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. And when I did, I sort of renewed my interest in film as something to do. Mm-hmm. We had a really great video store. This was like in the late 90s. And we had a really great video store in town that had a library pass where you could pay a monthly fee and have as many movies as you wanted in a month, but only 3 at a time. So I basically took it on myself to start learning about like the entire history of cinema and renting a bit of everything. And since then, I've sort of been watching, I kind of watch everything. I watch art films, I watch classic Hollywood, I watch genre films, I watch everything.
Yeah, and you do a pretty nice job of offering capsule reviews. They're short, but they're pretty insightful. I don't do a lot of commenting on that, but yeah, I've been pretty impressed by your grasp of film, your eclectic tastes, and really what you're describing there. You like to think, you like to talk, you're enthusiastic about movies. Yeah, I feel like I'm listening in the mirror or something here, because we share a lot of the same characteristics, and I think Derek probably fits into that category as well. So yes, there is a place for you in the wonderful world of podcasting. So this is your podcasting debut as well, is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. I've never done it before.
Welcome.
Yeah.
But I enjoy this podcast quite a bit, and that was why I volunteered.
Well, it's really great to have you, and it's always a pleasure to have new voices, new perspectives, and I'm very, very eager to hear what both of you guys have to say about this film. So, anything else? Do you have, like, any websites, or do you just basically do your stuff on Facebook? Are you a Letterboxd guy? What else? How else can people connect with you and hear or read some of your thoughts on these movies?
I am on Letterboxd. Okay. I tend to, everything I put on Facebook, I also put on Letterboxd, but more or less, I just put stuff in those two locations.
Cool. All right, well, send me a link, and we'll put that on the show notes so people can check out your stuff. Go ahead.
Sure, for sure. I used to write reviews for a site called AV Maniacs. It doesn't exist anymore. That was, like, related to genre films.
Mm-hmm.
But since that went dark, I haven't really been doing that anymore.
All right. Well, it's good that you got an archive, you got an outlet for that stuff. And again, I'll encourage listeners to check it out, because Richard's got a good insight here. So let's get into this one. Drive, he said, as we say, is part of the BBS set, directed by Jack Nicholson. Karen Black is in it. Bruce Dern. Those are probably the names that are probably the most preeminent. Neither of them are cast in the lead roles. The lead is a guy named William Tepper. He was a 23-year-old actor who apparently had sufficient athletic chops to carry off the lead role. And then there was another young man, Michael Margotta. There are a couple of roommates. They're cast as college, young men in college. And this is a film that basically blends kind of a sports memoir that was based on a fictional novel, which I get every impression was written by a guy who was kind of talking about his own college experience in the early 1960s. 1964 is when that was published. This is a film produced 6-7 years later, where the 60s have really exploded. And so we've got this mix of college athletics, campus militant radical activism, some generational stuff going on between the students and the faculty, and a very interesting homoerotic element to the whole thing as well. So it's quite a potent little stew, although I'm not sure it exactly works successfully. I don't know. I have got very mixed opinions, because I watched it just this weekend for the first time several days ago, and had a very mixed response. Like, there's some interesting bits, but there's some things that just sort of flopped. And I watched it again just this afternoon, and I found myself very amused and entertained by the whole thing. So we'll see if my verdict changes at all. But, the story is about this basketball player who's kind of figuring out what he's going to do as his career is kind of winding down, and his roommate, who's taken the more political activist route and is very intent on avoiding the draft. He kind of sets himself up to, flunk out of the draft exams. Of course, this is the height of the Vietnam War. And that's really kind of that's the stew that gets to boiling. The athlete is having an affair with one of his professor's wives. That's the Karen Black role. And so there's some shenanigans going on there. But it's really just a kind of an assemblage of ideas and set pieces and moments that, I don't know, it kind of fits into the fervor of the times. But I don't know, who wants to pick up anything that I've said there? Here's a thread that I'll throw out and let somebody pick it up and run with it.
You know, this is a film I really want to like. Mm-hmm. I mean, very actively. Like, normally when I say I want to like something, I mean I wish I did and I don't.
Yes. Yeah.
But that's not what I mean. Like, this is the second time viewing it. I saw it when I first got the BBS set. And it was one of the reasons I really wanted the BBS set, because I knew about this film and it was totally unavailable. And on first viewing, I thought it was immensely disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
On second viewing, I'm like, well, it's like three quarters disappointing.
Sure. Yeah, we could. So it notches up just a little bit, maybe once you're over that, you know, kind of what the hell factor, right?
It's full of a lot of good things. I just don't think any of them work with each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's an important film for Nicholson because it's kind of this crossroads for him where he'd spent the 60s being an actor and a sort of a failed actor in a way. You know, he worked for Roger Corman. He started writing a couple of films for Roger Corman. He actually directed one day's work on the movie The Terror. And he's just hitting as an actor when he makes this, and he uses his clout with BBS to direct this movie. And I think it definitely shows that he probably is a better actor.
Yeah, and he had also been involved in some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. You know, he was a screenwriter on the Monkees movie Head.
Yeah.
He was in those Monty Hellman westerns, that kind of double set there. And I thought it was pretty effective in that. And, of course, Easy Rider was his huge breakthrough. And then Five Easy Pieces, which I consider one of our more successful episodes. I mean, I've produced a lot of good episodes on this podcast, but that was one I'm really proud of because I got a lot of really great conversations with different folks. And that was a very powerful, you know, Oscar-nominated film and a real breakthrough. So you're right. You know, Nicholson got himself some clout. And I think as he's seeing Dennis Hopper acting and directing movies and, you know, he wants to be a Renaissance man himself. I kind of feel like this vaunting ambition here is part of the glory of this BBS set, and also some of its Achilles heel. Derek, what's your response to this film?
I guess it's also mixed. And I was thinking about this too. I'll get the positives out of the way first. I would say I'm actually going to defend Nicholson as a director, because it's clear that he had, and actually the one of the disappointing things about the presentation is that there's not as much information on it as you would like to get. I mean, the only, other than the trailer, the only supplement you have is sort of a 10-minute collection of like interview bits, which includes Nicholson but also Bruce Dern and Fred Roos, who was involved as an associate producer and kind of giving some background about the production, but not that much. But all that being said, it's clear that to me that Nicholson had a vision for what he was doing. And like, he was very, very adamant about what he wanted to make. And the other thing I think I praise him for is because I think even then, you know, even this was after Five Easy Pieces, but this was before One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and all the things he would be known for later. But I think he had enough confidence in himself as an actor to be able to translate that to the actress he's working with, because I don't recall a really bad performance in it. There's definitely over the top stuff, you know, certainly with
Robert Town.
Well, I mean, it works. I mean, there was nothing that felt out of place, you know, with it. You know, I think the performances were true to the characters that they were portraying. So, and also that it wasn't just depending on being big and bombastic, but there was even some nice subtle performances as well. So I think he had it, but, And I think he had the vision. I think that's why it works for what it is. But the negatives is I personally find it to be way too much of its own time. And I think it hasn't dated all that particularly well. And like some of the stuff, I just kind of roll my eyes about, you know, some of the like the youth ennui that was going on at the time, and especially Gabriel. I think Gabriel was probably the one that character that really put me off, just his whole antics to avoid the draft and go all situationalist and hey, let's do onto the college campus what was done in France in May 1968, and it's just like it's just kind of a bore.
Yeah, honest. There is well, it's over the top. It's you know, scenery chewing, hamming it up, theatrical. But you know, I guess somewhat in defense, I mean, if you've studied the career of a guy like Abbie Hoffman or Jerry Rubin, that's kind of what those guys were doing, you know? I mean,
right.
It may be that the ethos of 1970-71, the campus radicalism itself has not aged very well. I'm just not sure the rhetoric and the overt righteousness really stacks up. You know, it seems kind of buffoonish and incredibly narcissistic, self-indulgent, a lot of the things that the yuppie generation has been kind of lambasted for in its in its career over the last 50 odd years now. So yeah, like I say, I think it's maybe true to its time, but those times may not have the attraction, especially to younger viewers. I mean, I think that's the part that I found so amusing when I rewatched it today. It's just like it's just so full of itself. You sort of right. laugh at the naivety and the blindness of it all, but they are kind of caught up in their moment, and Gabriel in particular, with his righteous screeds and his ramped up pseudo madness that finally succumbs. Right. I mean, I don't want to get to the conclusion quite yet, but it is. It's just like, you got to be kidding me.
Well, it reminds me of, I have to confess, I have a bit of an ambivalence for the whole BBS set, and which is, there's definitely some things that I like in there. I mean, I like Five Easy Pieces. I'm looking forward to revisiting The Last Picture Show. And I even like Head because of its sort of anarchic craziness as well as what it meant for the Monkees at the time. But at the same time, it also, I mean, I grew up hearing about how great and wonderful the Boomers were in their youth. And at this point, I'm so sick of it at this point. Like Easy Rider, I find to be one of the most overrated films. Like I hear about it a lot about, oh, this is so important for our generation, the Boomers, and this is a big deal youth film. It's like, yes, I get it. And when I finally saw it from beginning to end, when I first got the set, I just like, okay, it was what it was, but like, there's nothing really special about it. So I think that's, it's the same sort of thing with Drive, he said. It's very much of its time. And it just, like, I can't really get into it. It's like the same thing with films like Vanishing Point. I mean, I could appreciate it, but it's just not.
Sorry.
No, that's okay, Richard. Pick it up. Vanishing Point isn't going to be covered on the podcast unless Criterion really slips it in very quickly.
Yeah.
But Tulane Blacktop isn't that far away either.
We're already at daggers drawn at this point.
Yes. You know, it's interesting. I think that Five Easy Pieces is a good comparison point for this film. Because, like, set aside his roommate for a minute, the William Tappert character, he's very much like Jack Nicholson's character in Five Easy Pieces.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's got things going for him. He's successful, and he's rejecting it. But
He's got all the gifts, all the advantages, all the what would become to be known as the white privilege, you know, white male privilege. And yet it kind of leaves a sour taste in his mouth. He's kind of floundering around figuring out what else is there. You know?
Yeah. But I think there's two huge differences that sort of sour this film a bit on me for me. One, Tappert's fine. The basketball scenes in this movie are amazing. Mm-hmm. And Tappert clearly is a great basketball player, as well as the guy from Hill Street Blues.
The Easley character?
Yeah.
Is it Michael Warren? Is that his name? Yeah. Tappert was throwing some pretty nice layups in there and passing and running the lane. I mean, there's some good athleticism on screen for sure.
He's nothing like Jack Nicholson.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. There's right. no charisma he, there, right, right.
He's weak as a he's weak as the main actor. He's not terrible, but he's weak. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why he's disaffected. Like, I know why Jack Nicholson is disaffected in Five Easy Pieces. This guy is disaffected, like an assertion.
Yeah.
And I don't think I get any insight as to what he wants. And I do kind of at least know what Jack wants in Five Easy Pieces. I'm not saying that...
Right, you meet his family. You get to see the backstory of kind of what he was up against, why he is the way he is. We know nothing about Hector, you know?
No. Yeah, you don't get enough background about why Bloom thinks the way he does. Just get little snippets here and there.
And for example, just like... And it sort of... This points towards the other problem I have with the film. I'm skipping into the plot a little bit.
That's okay. Yeah, we go all over the place here.
So he gets his shot at the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And David Ogden Stier shows up.
Yes.
And he wants... The only thing he wants is cheaper hot dogs that are better. And then this scene ends, and we... Other than one mention of this, it just never happens again.
Yeah, there's no cause. There's no drive there. And of course, Five Easy Pieces, you know, Bobby Dupuy is, you know, famously ambivalent. I mean, is he after the women? Is he what is he after? Is he just out there to raise hell? Who knows? But you're right. There's and I think that's actually a pretty insightful take, both of you, that the elements are there to make a pretty compelling film, but you've got to connect them to some kind of, you know, underarching theme that kind of propels it from point A to, you know, point Z at the end of the film. And it's just not there. So, yeah, I could probably, I think my enjoyment of the film today was sort of setting aside, because I knew the problems that were going to be there, but I could just kind of enjoy the absurdity and the, I don't know, kind of the reveling in its own high-mindedness. I kind of feel the fervor of these, you know, kind of observers of the yippie scene, of the campus sexual revolution, the, you know, just the enjoyment of basketball. Obviously, Jack Nicholson went on to become a very, you know, he was probably one of the most famous basketball fans of the last, you know, century, and you know, courtside at the Lakers games, and you can see that his love of the game goes further back, and he really, in fact, that little 10-minute segment you talked about, Derek, he talks quite a bit about how he had to really cast not just the one team, you know, his star players, but he cast several teams because the Ohio Leopards are playing a variety of competition. And you know, if you just enjoy that kind of thing, and some of those scenes actually reminded me of some of the Olympic set, you know, that kind of soft focus, fuzzy, blurry, rapid cutting situation, you know, on the court, where you're really thinking more about the power of the body in motion than what's actually happening on the scoreboard or anything like that. And I think those were good choices. They weren't really talking about who's winning, who's losing, but, you know, what's going on physically and mentally out there on the court. So that was an interesting element, and it's not anti-athletic either. You know, a lot of the, you know, hippie activists were, you know, kind of deriding of jock culture. I think this gives jock culture a fair representation.
Oh, this is beautiful. Sorry, there's a beautiful statement in that about, I mean, the one thing I do understand about the movie, about the William Tapper character, is why he likes basketball. He talks about it being physical poetry.
Yeah.
And I thought that's a beautiful line. And now I kind of understand this character, and it doesn't really go anywhere.
But yeah, why would he squander all of that for 25 cent, you know, grass-fed ground beef hot dogs or something like that?
Yeah, right. And like one of the, like another issue I'd say is that the two best performances in that film are Bruce Dern and Karen Black.
Sure, they're their most accomplished actors of the the entire cast, and they definitely make an impression. I feel though these are quality entries in their catalog.
And I think the Tapper character interacts quite a bit with Karen Black.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the aspects of the film I kind of like, because I do understand their relationship. He interacts with Bruce Dern, but I don't, it doesn't, there's the setup of a conflict and it never has any payoff, you know?
Yeah.
Like Bruce Dern wants him to do something, to be a better, not a better player, but a more responsible player.
Right.
And it just kind of trails off.
Yeah. Is Hector, is he kind of a dirty player? I mean, there's a big brawl, a big fight scene on the court that gets him ejected, and then he's kind of semi-kicked off the team. And is he going to play again? And yeah, exactly. So there's that.
And he
little...
refuses his punishment during the practice.
Right. He walks out. I'd rather not. Yeah. You know. So yeah. Is that some kind of crisis of conscience? Is some kind of kind of an ethical line he doesn't want to cross? Is he mounting a protest? No, he's just kind of being indecisive and dumb, and then he kind of weasels his way back on the team. And you're right. So there's these conflicts that are set up, but there's never. I mean, there's a resolution because something happens to, you know, sort of break the tension, but there's never anything that's all that compelling as to why he chose one way or the other.
It's interesting. I watched the, that little extra feature. Mm-hmm. And one thing I noticed in the interviews with Nicholson, he keeps telling stories like this happened during the shooting of it. And I mm-hmm. could never quite figure out why he was telling the story. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, they're funny stories, but they don't really
resolve into anything. And that felt to me like the perfect extra for the movie, because it felt to me like Jack is telling me all these little funny stories about the characters, but he doesn't know where it's going or why.
Yeah. Right. He's filmed a bunch of bits, and I have to imagine they had a lot of fun making this movie.
I had a lot of fun watching it.
Yeah. I mean, they're right. There's if you dig the sensibility of that era, even if you can't fully climb on board, but you find it interesting, if it doesn't repel you, then I think this movie has a lot going for it, because it is very full of unusual stuff that you might not see in a lot of other films, you know. Let's go back to the Karen Black situation. I mean, this is an interesting theme here. You've got the younger wife of a professor. She's probably just a few years older than the athletes, and Hector's having an affair with her, and she, Karen Black, gets to play a character with a little bit more complexity and depth to it than even I think what she had in Five Easy Pieces. What do you guys think about that? Is this a better performance or a maturing Karen Black? What would you like about her particular contributions to this film?
Ooh, I guess she was fine in it. Mm-hmm. I guess like your problem, Richard, with not knowing as much about Bloom, and I think that also probably would, well, maybe there was, I just didn't pick it up as quickly or something, but it kind of would have been nice to know a little bit more about what was going on in her head and what she was conflicted about, or what she was trying to go for.
I think part of it was just that she was kind of fed up with her husband. I mean, who was, you know, the epitome of the ineffectual intellectual, right? I mean,
right.
He's a college professor. He kind of sees his wife waiting to meet up with this star athlete, big man on campus, you know, stud, and he sort of almost enables, would you mind giving her a ride? Well, you know, it's pretty obvious they were about to take their own ride, and he's so complicit, and you know, she's just sizing it up. I mean, everybody's knowing what's going on. Nobody's ever putting it into so many words. And I don't know, in a way that's almost a bit of a cliche, but
yeah,
like most cliches, there's a substance or there's a reality behind it.
There's a reason why it's a cliche.
And there must have been some resonance to that type of dynamic. I mean, we're we're decades away from the Me Too movement and some of the shenanigans that would go on college campuses. I think John Updike and John Cheever and all those other literary types from that era made great hay with these types of relationships. And so here we've got some of that happening on film here. But I don't know. I mean, I do feel like she got to display some nuance there. And of course there is that, you know, kind of more overt sexuality, which I think was also probably one of the films, at least it was an attempt to be a calling card. I think this is also testing the limits and taking advantage of the new freedoms and the, you know, the lack of censorship that was happening in Hollywood films of this era.
It's got a truly heroic amount of male nudity.
Yeah, it really is fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I was just like, this was not just little flashes here and there. There were, well, I mean,
no, it's
Symphony
it's
of Dicks, according to Jack.
Overwhelmingly more male nudity than female in it. And I'm not even sure that was intended. It just sort of, I mean,
yeah.
It's part
oh,
of
it was intended.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, Nicholson basically had that in mind for his opening scene, and it wasn't that far from it, you know, and it wasn't just that one scene. That it's beginning, middle, and end. And do you think that might have been a little bit of a factor as to why the film did not resonate so well at the box office? Is that a little more than audiences were bargaining for at the time?
It's certainly unusual. Yes. I think even in that era, it's unusual. I can't think of many films with this much male nudity in it. Well, to go back a second.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, fine.
I did think that Karen Black's character is a bit like, I mean, go back to the Five Easy Pieces comparison. Mm-hmm. Her complaint is perhaps a bit like Susan Anspach's complaint in that.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't think Tappert's offering her anything. Like she ends up pregnant, right? Mm-hmm. Her husband is self-absorbed, to say the least. Yeah. I'm not impressed with Robert Towne's performance, but he has the best line in the movie where he says, I didn't want to talk about this as much as I thought I did.
Yeah.
The ultimate wilting moment, you know?
Yeah. But I don't think Tappert offers her anything, right? I mean, I don't think he knows what he wants to do. I don't think I mean, he declares he's in love with her, but I don't think he is.
Yeah, that is so empty, right?
Well, he's also 21, 22, and going through ennui anyway, so.
Yeah.
Well, he's a stud athlete. I mean, I think that's pretty obvious. But she got her fill of that, and then he was, you know, kind of lacking in the self-awareness that he wants to chase her around campus and have open conversations with her. And she's like, no, you're my fuck buddy, basically. And that's all you are. And don't make it any more than what it is. And that's,
I'm pregnant. My husband might be a twit, but at least he's going to be there.
Right. And even at the big crisis at the end where she's screaming bloody murder, he's the one who wraps her back up and takes her into that nice house, you know?
Right.
So there's a comfort and a stability there that she's going to fall back on rather than getting into these goofy, you know, delusional kids who don't really know what they're about. So
his roommate trying to rape her. So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what is this kind of some kind of bizarre psychodrama? I guess that's his arc. You know, he opens the scene with this kind of theatrical, you know, guerrilla theater stunt. You know, taking a whole arena full of basketball players and fans hostage to have his kind of whimsical, you know, protest moment, which, and again, it is a kind of an echo of, you know, the Kent State situation that happened while this film was being made, and so many other campus protests, and the University of Oregon where this was filmed, you know, Oregon, Ohio, the green and gold colors of the Ohio Leopards matching pretty much the Oregon Ducks. So I guess they probably had some spare uniforms that they use and all of that. But, you know, there was an actual campus riot, and some of that footage found its way into the film as well. So, again, they're trying to capitalize on the, you know, the headlines, the sensations, you know, people freaking out to avoid the draft, campus riots, and just all the turbulence of that era. They want to get it on film because they're going to tell it like it is, the way that the old squares aren't quite ready to either understand or, you know, present to you with an unvarnished, you know, clear-eyed perspective. I think those are the ambitions of this film, but it just feels like, you know, student riots in general. They kind of make their noise and they kind of fall apart and don't really accomplish a whole lot.
Yeah. And an interesting bit of serendipity, University of Oregon would also be the setting for Faber College.
Oh, in the Animal House. Okay. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Well, they must have a pretty good, you know, rights arrangement or something like that. Yeah. Richard, do you want to jump in with something there?
Yeah. So I said I was bracketing like his roommate, and I don't dislike that plot. I think it's pretty good. I don't know how it connects to the rest of the film.
Okay, so Gabriel. Well, if the idea is that Gabriel and Hector are roommates, maybe
I understand that part.
Yeah,
right. It feels arbitrary. Mm-hmm, like, I mean, it's like it doesn't play into anything really. They have a few conversations about his roommate not appreciating basketball as much as he does.
But right.
I don't feel. If the movie made me think that some of William Tappert's, like, displeasure with his future as a basketball player was that he thought his roommate was right, I think I understood why his roommate was in the movie, but the movie doesn't really have that.
Yeah. You'd think Hector could have some kind of a political leaning. Does he support the war? Is he glad that he has this athletic gift and can go pro and avoid the draft altogether because he's kind of got his ticket out of all of that? Does he approve or disapprove of Gabriel's antics? I mean, he's so neutral on everything. That's another good observation. You know, there's plenty of opportunity for some creative tension. These guys might have just been, you know, two knuckleheaded freshmen who got thrown together as roommates, but now over a few years of college, they've grown, they've matured, they've drifted into different tracks. And, you know, there's a friendship, but there's a tension there. But you're right, there's just none of that. That these things are happening alongside each other. Even as it's playing in my monitor right now, this is the scene where Hector walks in after Gabriel and you know, he's kind of blown up with one of his girlfriends, kind of in this loft situation. And you're right, there could be a little bit more of a poignant or pointed confrontation, and I don't know, it just fizzles. Yeah.
To a large degree, it felt to me like on the left channel, I've got Five Easy Pieces running. Mm-hmm. On the right channel, I have Alice's Restaurant running.
There you go.
And they're both kind of enjoyable, but I don't really understand why they're in the same movie. Right? And that, like, I don't have much of a complaint. The actor playing his roommate seems to have played that part before, since he's in The Strawberry Statement and
he's
a bunch of other movies.
Wild in the Streets, I think, was the other casting
the other
that he had.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, and he's obviously shown his readiness for that type of a role. Well, so let's talk about Gabriel then. I mean, because he probably does create some of the more lasting impressions of this film. Again, I haven't seen it since, I mean, I've only watched it for the first time recently. But I think some of the scenes that I will most remember of this film definitely feature Gabriel.
Right.
I remember one of the links you sent said he deserved an Academy Award nomination for putting his private parts in the most amount of danger on screen.
We'll get to that concluding scene in a moment, because I think that's where you're referring. But let's talk about his freak out in the exam room. I mean, that was quite a moment there, or a series of moments. I can't help but think of some of the famous anecdotes about Ted Nugent that I recall. I remember reading that as a teenager of how he used to, you know, brag about how he crapped his pants and was acting the fool. And anybody who knows Ted Nugent, all politics aside, knows that Ted can certainly act the fool. And that's how he apparently, at least by his own account, back in the 1970s or early 80s when I first read that, that's how he got out of having to do active service in Vietnam. I don't know that he's telling those same stories nowadays. His tune has changed as his hair has grayed and his politics have shifted ever to the rightward there. But, I can imagine there was a contingent of viewers who either themselves had gone through situations like this or had contemplated it, or knew other people who had actually done this kind of self-inflicted meltdown to avoid military service. And it does make me wonder how much the military had to deal with filtering that stuff out. Like, is this person just putting on a show, or are they seriously, truly mentally disturbed? And if we draft this guy against his will, you know, what kind of chaos is he going to stir up in boot camp and all of that? But I don't know. Do you guys have anything to say just about sort of the psychological / political element of that whole situation of a guy who's kind of lost all of his other options? He doesn't want to get drafted, and he resorts to desperate measures to avoid that dilemma.
I mean, I can understand going through that, but again, I've grown up with hearing about how the young folk did not want to be involved in Vietnam, and they would dodge the draft or again resort to theatrics. That it was just kind of like, okay, I was kind of disaffected by it. I guess mm-hmm. another thing I was thinking of was. I was thinking, like, why did it take that long for them to kind of figure out that maybe he's not worth the trouble? But like you said, they're probably just kind of feeling him out a bit. It's like, okay, is he just doing this for a show, or is he really, really unhinged? And I guess it took confronting the psychiatrist to finally make the point.
Well, he basically did a full on, you know, facial assault on the guy. I mean, right. even just the gymnastics of that performance was, I mean, he really threw himself into that role, quite literally, quite physically. And then we can maybe talk about his, whether it was the drugs, the paranoia, the fervent belief in his own righteous cause, but he loses it pretty completely at the end there. What a performance.
And I feel like I'll echo my comments about the rest of the film.
Yeah.
I enjoy it, but I don't know why it happened.
Yeah, right. I mean, because literally it goes from the scene where he's got the pantyhose over his face and his nose is all smushed up, and he's basically playing psycho killer, terrorizing Olive, the professor's wife, Karen Black. And then the professor gets home and Hector also happens to show up. So you got this big dramatic culmination. All four of your lead characters are right there in this moment of absolute crisis. And then the professor walks his wife into the house. And the very next scene, I believe, is Gabriel running naked for straight into the camera. And it's like, what?
Yeah. And he lets all the little guys loose.
Yeah. Yeah, yep. Right. He gets into the science lab where all the test animals and reptiles and stuff. And again, what is the purpose? Is he some kind of animal rights liberation guy? Is he somehow bonding and identifying with these lower level life forms and he wants to set them free? He doesn't really have to prove to anybody that he's crazy now. He's already got his draft exemption, right?
No, I assume the idea is somehow between the drugs and acting crazy, he's driven himself crazy. But it feels like that should be an entire movie of its own. And it's just a small side plot in this movie that feels topical, but not really related to what we've been watching for like 3/4 of the film.
Right,
it doesn't feel like it ties back to William Tappert's character.
No, no, he's pretty much. I mean, all he has left to do is chase after the paddy wagon and say your mother called. you know,
right, yeah.
Like I guess that's their idea of a poignant conclusion. But we don't even know who Gabriel's mother is.
Yeah, it wasn't earned. Like right. Yeah, that line seemed to like come out of nowhere.
Right. They're trying to come up with sort of a whiz bang ending there, something that kind of, you know, pulls the string and kind of ties it all together. But it's just like, I don't think so. You know, I mean, you got to finish this movie up. And I guess if you get back to the spirit of the times type of a mentality here, they cobbled these scenes together. They shot the footage. They enacted these moments, these characters, and now you've got to edit it and make it happen. So,
yeah, I guess the warning sign is that when you have four editors involved, that, mm-hmm. and if you're not Terrence Malick, then you should probably be concerned.
Who apparently did a rewrite on this.
Yes, yeah, he did. Yeah, yeah, he did uncredited rewrites.
Yeah. Everybody, there's so many people of interest in this thing.
Like, there really is.
Cindy yeah. Williams shows up. Mm-hmm. And,
yeah, yeah, that's another uncredited role, right? She's the young brunette who's just sitting on the bleachers, but she's shot in several scenes. I'm like, oh yeah, that's Shirley.
I even noticed his roommate's girlfriend that's in the couple of scenes
mm-hmm.
is in Up in Smoke.
Okay. Oh, that's right. Yeah.
She's the Ajax.
The Hoover.
Up in Smoke. Yeah.
Is she Small the girl world. With fuck on her forehead? Is that the same one there? Or is that someone
yes,
different?
It is. I noticed it was her because she did a facial expression in this movie yes. that reminded me of her facial
yeah,
expression
that
in
kind
Up
of
in Smoke.
Twisted
yeah.
lip
yeah,
diagonal.
Yeah, so I looked her up. I thought, oh, I am right.
Well, that's her talent, I guess.
Wow. And Henry Jaglom is in this movie.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, he's the leader of the I guess that the Radicals are a theater group?
Well, right, that's the thing. Yeah, this isn't like, I mean, you know, the very first time I watched it, just again this past weekend, I thought, wow, is this going to be like a terrorist attack? I mean, all the elements were there, and of course, that just turns out to be just a pop gun with a little flag that unfurls. It's like, oh, just... you know, yippie street theaters.
Well, yeah, those yeah. scenes, I, another thing that I thought of when I saw those scenes and then later on when the group were discussing amongst themselves, like when you're in a real war, when you're dead, it looks like you could just cut those scenes and you can insert it into like La Chinoise or Godard's, any of Godard's Dziga Vertov 70s films like Tout Va Bien and so on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. Or Milos Forman's hair.
yeah, yes.
Right.
So I'll tell you what, I'll give Jack a great bit of credit in this. He says something in the bonus feature that I think is part of the key to this movie. He says that when adapting a novel that's this impressionistic, you have to take a lot of the things that are in people's heads and externalize them.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I don't think he's done enough of that.
Well, he took some... Well, I think he took some stuff out and put other stuff in. It's his own expressionism. It's his own, you know, sense of being in the moment. I mean, I do feel there was a kind of a heady grandiosity behind this film that says we're going to throw all the big ideas of 1970, you know, into this thing, and it's going to grab the world by the throat, and it's really going to, you know, kind of show them where it's at. And I think Nicholson had been around enough that he wasn't, you know, just completely
neophyte.
Maybe yeah, right. And I would say even Dennis Hopper probably was more grandiose in that way than Jack Nicholson was. I mean, the last movie, for all of its flamboyant, overblown zeal, is pretty intriguing because it's just so huge in its scale. But it's even more of a disappointing flop in its own way than this is because the ambition is kind of it's there and it's an impressive spectacle, but it doesn't really pay off unless you really want to insist that it does. I guess that's my take on the last movie, you know. I'm glad it's there. I'm glad that we've got a very nice definitive release. It looks beautiful in places. But, you know, there's a reason that these films just, you know, went down in ignominious flames, and the studios didn't really want to turn the reins over to these guys as directors for quite a long time. And yet I'm looking at the poster that I'm going to put in the show notes here. This is a original release poster. The disenfranchisement, or the disenchantment, I should say, of an all-American jock is the tagline. Quotes from Show magazine, one of the most important pictures of the year, and
yep.
Dan Lewis from Bell McClure Syndicate, the best picture I've seen this year, and another tagline, don't lie, don't cheat, don't be afraid. Well, I would say, you know, Jack Nicholson probably was not afraid. I can't say he didn't exactly lie or cheat in making this film, but you know, it's a good slogan.
Well, again, I appreciate when directors have a vision, even if it is maybe half-baked or not completely there or whatever, but if you believe in it very strongly and are able to put it out there in some form, I appreciate it more. And in that sense, I'm actually more of an agreement with Vincent Canby, and he had a more ambivalent response to it as well. Like he knew that it fell short in places, but he admired that it was daring to do something different. It wasn't, you know, the same old tripe that was going on in that time. So I can imagine this being like against the grain of, it certainly went against the grain of mainstream fare, and it certainly stands out in that way. But I don't think it stands terribly well on its own.
Yeah. Yeah. The daring is there, and he didn't play it safe.
Yeah, and I give a lot more respect to films that are daring, that do try to do something different rather than just play it safe. So this film does not play it safe.
It's the most interesting film he directed. I mean, the other two are not anywhere close to as interesting as this.
Yeah, one is Going South. What's the other one? The name is
The Two Jakes.
Right.
The sequel to Chinatown.
Right. And there, I think he was actually legitimately trying for commercial success on the sort of the mainstream level, and again, fizzled out there. Here, yeah, he's taking risks. And again, in the moment that it was filmed in, I do appreciate that. That's one of the reasons I'm very content to review all of these films from 1971, because every single one of them is definitely interesting. Yeah. Successful. Perhaps not. Lasting landmarks of cinema? No, probably these are as forgettable in some of their own ways as, you know, films of many other years, but the times themselves were just so interesting. And this is our, I guess, in the 1971 season three of this podcast, this is our first actual true new Hollywood. You know, we talked about Sweet Sweetback, and we talked about Wanda in this season, but they weren't really new Hollywood. They were indie American films in their own way. But this is part of that moment, that movement. And, you know, for better or worse, I think this is a pretty fair representation of what that scene was all about, in particular the BBS and its somewhat mixed track record. So, yeah, this is probably a good time to start wrapping things up. Are there any other moments, scenes, situations that have to be commented on before we, draw this to a close?
I think I can sum it up by saying this kind of reminds me of Dazed and Confused and its spiritual sequel, Everybody Wants Some, except it takes itself way more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are some comedy elements here, but you're right. I think this is still a film that's striving to make a statement, you know, especially the way that it ends. I am totally straight. I am seeing you as you see me. You know, this kind of pompous, you know, I am not crazy. You're the one who's in jail, buddy. You're in jail.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Shake that fist, man. Power to the people.
Viva la revolution.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So Richard, how about your bottom line on Drive, he said?
I mean, it's worth a view. I think
Absolutely.
I mean, it's definitely worth a view. There's a lot of things to like in it, as long as you keep in mind that I'd say the first quarter of it, the first third of it, maybe, is quite an interesting film, and from then on, it's quite an interesting collection of scenes.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a very fair assessment. You know, there's challenging ideas. I watched it with one of my sons, actually, and he was kind of amused and intrigued. You know, he's just 31 years old right now. So, you know, he's grown up with my stories of living through the 70s and 80s and he's got a little historical consciousness, but I think he found it pretty interesting just to see this little representation of college life. So if you are one of the younger set, I definitely say check this out and just think about it. You know, I mean, I know, you know, it's, I don't want to really get too political at this particular moment as the podcast is getting ready to wrap up, but you know, people think we're just living in these apocalyptically terrible times as a culture, as a society and our government and everything. You know what? it's been pretty terrible for a long time, if you really want to.
That's the one comforting thing about knowing history, is that, you know, we've been through worse.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and the jerks have been running the show for, you know, for centuries, millennia, really. And those are the people who tend to want to get into those positions to begin with. So, you know, give yourself a little perspective on what all's happening. So, very good. All right, well, Richard, it's been great having you on. I think you are signed up for some future episodes, so we will be getting you back here down the road. Derek, you're fairly much a regular here, so I don't know that your names are on the list for a little bit here, but we'll find time for you. I've enjoyed the conversation, and I hope listeners have as well. So, Richard, we'll get your letterbox profile. Derek, will you get any links or business that you want to share with listeners of what you've been up to or how people can get a hold of you?
Well, I'm very active on Facebook. You can find me there. I'm active a little bit on Twitter, but that's just more for music stuff. And I'm looking for more excuses to use Letterboxd more. But yeah. Any of the major social media places, you can find me.
Excellent. Okay, Richard, well, thanks again for your podcasting review. I think you've passed the audition. We'll have you back again, okay?
All right.
It's a deal. Excellent. Okay. Good night, everybody. Our next episode is going to be me and Josh Hornbeck talking about Socrates, the Rossellini history film that didn't make it into the Eclipse set, but we'll give us something to think about. Okay. We'll talk to you later. Good night.
Take care. Bye.
Army, war, shoot, blood, fear, kill. No way, man, no way. I'm making a stand right here. That's all there is to it. For me, it is strictly a survival trip.
Bothers me not knowing what to do next.
Doesn't have anything to do with anything. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't take you anywhere.
Well, the college, junior college.
My college is full of shit.